Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, good morning. This is Kevin Boylo, Nazarita Goldhammer, co-host of Epis Radio. Here we are, right back at you. It's March 15th. Monday. And today's radio show is kind of a natural extension of what we've been doing. The title of the show is Moving Design Away from Predatory Capitalism. So we've defined predatory capitalism before as an out-of-control form of capitalism in which the sole goal, with super minor exceptions, is to maximize profit. And you see it around you, everywhere you go. So what that means is that the market regulates all other value. I mean, that's our culture. That's our civilization. Is that the money market regulates all other values. So we've had some really good programs on design, innovative design, critical design, which we're not going to, you know, go away from. But we thought we would have some conversations about how to get there. If we're so inebriated with predatory capitalism, how do we imagine kind of design that's not based on that logic? And so I'm going to start today's show off with Nazarita Goldhammer, and let's just kind of move ourselves into it. I think it's a really important topic. It's an important topic because if we don't move away from predatory capitalism, then we're stuck with it. And that means all design is seen as a product of, you know, modern extraction logics, exploitation, et cetera, et cetera. But if we can move away from it, if that's even remotely possible, what does that look like and how does it affect design? Welcome to the show, Nazarita. We're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Yes. Great. What do you think about this issue of moving design away from predatory capitalism?
Well, I think that there's some at the heart of this issue, there are questions that we each have to ask ourselves as a singular presence, and then extending out to our family, our community, our city, our state, our nation, the earth. We have to ask ourselves some questions about design and who we are, and really, what we've said before is what we want to have for living on the earth, how we interact with others, how we treat other species, how we treat the earth. So lately I've been thinking a lot about spaciousness,
yeah.
Like spatioception, the sense that tells you how much space you're experiencing in your body. And how the concept of abstraction prevents us from experiencing the present, from connecting to the present. And I think I would say a lot of humans, 90% of all humans, live in this state of abstraction where we are thinking continually in terms of capitalism, whether we know it or not. That we need more shopping, more buying, more this, more that, more cars, more, you know, more contacts. But we forget that the present moment, we're losing by dwelling on all those things that prevent us from living in the present, that what those abstractions do is we lose the connection to the experience of the moment. Of the bird flying overhead, of, you know, the duck waddling in the park, the grass growing, the earth, the sun shining, the movement, the intrinsic movement of the earth and other species within it in connection to us, we lose that. And here's a really good example. And then I'll get to how I think it applies to design and housing, specifically housing in terms of how we design for many things. Our office buildings, our big buildings, you know, banks, all those things that go into design of buildings. So if you lose the concept of connection, then what you're doing is you're constantly thinking of something else. And everybody's had this experience where they're really worried about something or they're obsessively thinking about something and they go for a walk or their drive. And they don't remember actually seeing anything. Like, that's why a lot of wrecks are, is because people are thinking about something else or on their phones. They're not in the present moment. They're unaware of the sun shining, the birds flying. They're unaware of anything except for what goes on in their minds of this worry. And I think that this is especially important, like when people go out into nature, sometimes they used to bring, this ages me, they used to bring boom boxes. And it was like, so they're not really present in nature. They're present in another sphere. They're not present where they are. They're bringing something in there. It's an abstraction. So in predatory capitalism, the market obviously regulates where we live because it's how much money you make, what you can afford, what you desire for yourself. And it's very difficult to get out of what you have experienced previously in renting to go to something that might be healthier. A lot of middle class apartments, houses, condos, townhouses, they're made with violent materials. They're made with materials that off-gas, that actually harm our health. And yet, to have something that is more spacious available, made with better materials, what we're finding is you have to buy in, you have to make a lot more money in order to be healthy. And so that's the part of the predatory capitalism that we're seeing, that is regulating our value, our value as humans, our value as workers in the system, the value of a throwaway culture. That's really what we are. We're a throwaway culture. We throw away other species. We throw away materials. We throw away how we live. We throw away humans. That's part of this intense capitalism. You really don't matter. You matter as a body that works, and you can get a few pittance for what you do for your labor to try and live in a healthy, good lifestyle. Though many people don't even think that way, what they think of, what can they afford? How can they get around? How can they buy food? And we've talked about this, like what would be a place of spaciousness where you could design a living space. And you and I have talked about this in terms of we have overpopulation. And so when I say that we have to really, really look at how we perceive ourselves, our value, what our value is in the future, and how the value is that we connect to others in the earth. If we keep just producing children and producing, because our culture says it's healthy to have lots of children to carry on your genetic material so that maybe one of them can do something that you actually wanted to do with your life. They could be better than you. That's the whole range of why people have children, because they want something better, because they felt that they couldn't achieve the best. They had to have their children try and achieve the best. So it's this continuous mindfuck of saying this is you have to always produce more. You have to produce more labor to get more money. You have to produce more children to have a better life. You have to produce more. But that more cuts you off from the present. You're unable to see. People are very distracted. What they do is they give a few dollars to, you know, maybe someplace that saves, you know, feeds people or does something. You and I have talked about like the little armband that says that you support a group or something. But people are too busy. They're too busy. They're too engrossed in abstraction in order to actually do something. Their lives are too hectic, too busy. They have too much going on. It fills their every waking moment to see what's going to happen in the future, not to prevent what happened in the past or sustain the past. So the present is obscured. And we are in that position in our earth where we have to look at how we have children, how we overpopulate the earth, and what do we need to live in? What do we need to carry with us? What are we working for? Those are really questions. Well, who are we? Do we want? Life is short. And you may embrace the idea of reincarnation, of living again and again and again. But how many times can you live again where you acquire all the stuff continuously before you realize that the purpose of life is part of giving? And I just want to end this little comment with design, because design is an important part of this concept. If we thought differently, we would design differently, because we would see that we needed something different. We don't need what we have. Useless lawns proliferating in subdivisions, gated communities that keep others out. And so we have to really look at what we are becoming, what we want to become. And the beautiful story I want to end with is like Margaret Mead. Someone asked Margaret Mead, they said, what is the beginning of civilization? And everybody was like, they were expecting her to say, well, written language, or when they made the first tool. And she said, the first sign of what we interpret as civilization was when you find the bones of a healed femur bone. And she said, the reason why is that animals who break their femur bones, they can't live long enough in order for it to heal. They die before then because they can't get food, they can't walk, they're subjected to predatory animals. And so that shows that the first sign of civilization, she said, is when you find a healed femur bone. That meant that someone took the time to care for that person while they were healing. They fed them, they cared for them, they helped them until it could heal. That was the sign of giving, which is a sign of civilization. And I always thought that was really interesting, because the concept is not what you can acquire, not what you can make, but how you give. And that's an important concept in what we're talking about in design.
So, okay, all right. That's true. And I like the reference to Margaret Mead and the reference to anthropology and archaeology, because it gives us a sense of other ways of being. I think that's really interesting. That's super interesting. What is equally interesting to me is the future. What could we possibly do in the future? If we started from scratch right now, what could humans do? It's a great question. The reason it's a great question is because it excites our imagination. And I think a lot of people from all walks of life might consider other possibilities. They might imagine them in the future. So that's good. And then it's also interesting to think about sometimes in life when you get yourself in a jam, how do you get out of it? Like, what do? You know, if you're on a boat that's sinking, what do? Maybe we're on a boat that's sinking. Maybe not. But that is the situation we're in. And you and I have tried to describe it many different ways on our show. And we have a new book coming out in about 3 months on this very issue. So when you live in a culture that, let's say it's dominated by royalty, like a queen or a king or a despot or a tyrant, then that political community is completely logified by the whims and the being of the tyrant, because they determine everything. And that's why if you have a very wise ruler, things could be great. But if you have an unwise ruler, things could be really bad, which is why people even think about democracy or democratic forms of government. There's less risk involved, at least as the story goes. And we're learning that even that's not true anymore. So, similarly, if you have an economic, political community that's really built on, based on capitalism, like an all-encompassing capitalism, it's not even kind of a small capitalism or a highly regulated capitalism. It's an out-of-control capitalism. It's not just the dollar. It's more a way of thinking and a more a way of being. And I'm surprised when I meet some people sometimes who are so indoctrinated into capitalism, it affects every aspect of their self. This is important, because what it means is that any other kind of values, any other kind of tendencies, potentials in that person are really subjugated by capitalism, by this form. So it's my belief that when you have a capitalism that has really blossomed, it's matured out of greed, self-interest, narcissism, egocentric ways of being, that even morality, law, etiquette, display rules for emotion, everything gets regulated by this form. And so that means very little else gets to surface. And that's what we've called attention to on this show, is this predatory version. A predatory capitalism is a no-holds-barred logic, algorithm, even better, in which there are win-lose dynamics in every part of your life. Even marriage, we're seeing. It's all about win-lose dynamics from what we've been able to discern in some work that we do. And so therefore, if you have this out-of-control predatory capitalism that is so replete, it is so permeated in our thinking and our way of being, so structured, and so much so, you might be a person who doesn't even think about other options. You might be a person who thinks this is just the way things are. That's a problem, because that that degree of sedimentation means that you wouldn't have any motivation. You wouldn't have any space inside your consciousness to interrogate it. Now, I call that transcendence, and it comes from a transcendental faculty. And it really is there in consciousness. We talk about it in phenomenology, the space within which we consider new possibilities. So I'm going to put this back to you, Nazarita. How do we, if that space is so compromised, how can we possibly imagine new design, like new ways of being and new ways of constructing our culture? How do we do that?
Really is a difficult question. And so I think it's not an easy answer. It's an evolving answer. It's an evolving perception, and it's an evolving kind of like an archaeology dig into ourselves. And some of those questions are so important. And what I see in what we're asking ourselves of what does it really mean to be human, not only human in a species, but human interconnected with the earth and other creatures. Like, what does it mean, really? And those are questions that we should all be thinking of, which lead us to new perceptions of how we live, how we want to live, what is best for us and what is best for other creatures and species, and what is best for the earth. Now, none of this is being taught in schools. Like kids aren't asking those questions. Kids aren't being asked those questions. They're being asked to answer questions that fit them more into a society that is homogenized. They're learning by rote. They're taking tests. And I read a really great article on someone was saying, you know, this whole idea that kids are going to be far behind because of the pandemic. Oh, your kids are going to be behind because they haven't been in school for 8 hours a day, you know, subjected to these hour increments of someone forcing knowledge into their minds. And someone made a really good point. And they said, this is a construct of adults that say, oh, my kid's going to be far behind. Again, it's not living in the present. What it's saying is, I have these designs for my children to live in a certain way, to achieve a certain status. And the only way to achieve that is by doing this, and they are far behind in doing that. So it isn't reality. It isn't like how do you nurture inspiration? How do you nurture a way of thinking that gives a whole new dimension to the way that we live? So design is usually thought of as a function. Design. We want the best function for space. Design in big buildings. Big buildings were designed to house as many people as possible, being as productive as possible, with an overseer to make sure that they were just as productive as possible for the company that owned it, so they can make more money and they can pay the little pittance to the people that work there. So that's why you have big buildings. They're like, let's herd them into one big space so we can watch over them, make sure that they have, you know, this much time for lunch, this much time for a break, and that they are productive so that we can make money. That's predatory capitalism. And then a lot of subdivisions are based upon that too. How many houses can we have, get as much money as possible, that we could replicate as many materials as possible so that the subdivision can get as much money as possible with giving each person just a little bit of something that they might want so that they'll be satisfied to not want more. And so with this kind of thinking, you can't be innovative you cannot be innovative. You cannot access that inspiration that comes from really thinking about how to change the world. And again, we're running on a treadmill. A treadmill, you know, one of those wheels what we just keep running on till we're exhausted and someone else gets on to keep it running. It's like the Matrix. That's what we're doing. We're providing energy, but the energy isn't really feeding us. It's not making the world better. And by living in the present, we see the destruction that we're causing. You can't take the destruction and say, well, let's stop the destruction in 20 years after we have done these things. Let's give all the, I think the craziest thing I've ever heard is this. We know that the destruction of big business polluting the water should stop immediately. So people aren't sick, animals aren't sick, the earth isn't sick. But instead, capitalism says, well, we're going to pass a law that says you have to stop your destructive behavior by 20 years. But you have 20 years to keep doing what you're doing, even though we know it's causing a lot of problems. But because you've invested so much money in this destructive behavior, we feel like it's okay to give you this amount of time to continue that behavior, to make as much money as possible, to make up for the time when you can't make the money from that destructive behavior. That's the same with glyphosate, which we've talked about. This is a harmful chemical that pollutes our very world, and yet it's being sold at every single garden store in the country, almost every single one, 99% of them, because nobody wants to stop it because money's being made. And because money's being made, if you stop the money, oh, then workers are going to be out of business. And what happens to the building where it's made? It's like this is the wrong way of thinking. We need to back up. Back up. You know when you made a wrong turn somewhere? You don't keep driving on the wrong turn hoping that it might get you to the right place, even though you know it's wrong. You back up, you turn around, and you find the right direction. And I think that's an easy concept, don't you, to actually think about. It's not like you don't continue to drive on the wrong road hoping by some miracle.
Well,
let
me break in on that. That's a nice concept for when talking about a rational individual driving on the road. But when you're talking about a country with 200 to 300 million people and several countries with billions of people, the analysis becomes, in my view, a lot more complicated. And I think there's always a problem of knowledge. There's a problem of access to knowledge. I'd go so far to say, Nazarita, that a lot of people just don't know how bad things are. Like, they really don't know. They don't have access to knowledge, to information. And so their understanding comes from mythological, fictional anxieties that are triggered by what they hear. So it is a problem. The issue about moving away from predatory capitalism with design, I think, is really difficult. We may have to go through a period of like extreme destruction. Like really extreme destruction, and rebuild. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm considering that may have to happen. You know what I mean? Like where we do go over the cliff, and all is ruined. You know, and there's a little bit left of our human energy, and we rebuild with that. It's possible. But right now, like, what could explain why it's so difficult to move away from predatory capitalism? Structure. I mean, in our discussions just on this internet radio show, I have learned, I've really developed my understanding of how deep these structures are and how deeply embedded they are in our civilization, right? We've talked about, like, every domain, the structure of healthcare, government, science, relationships, family, art, professions, a building, even just design has had built an industry, you know, and in that industry, there are certain expectations and ways of doing things. So, and all of it is regulated by money. Slaughterhouses, they're completely kept in the inertia that they're in because of capitalism. Stockholders own shares in slaughterhouses. So the way the law is structured is that corporate directors can't do anything that would decrease the profits of the shareholders. That'd be unethical, and that would be illegal, be a civil tort, in fact, or a breach of contract at least. So, I mean, that's a great example. You know, we've talked about how stores are just a simple grocery store design is largely structured by the products of violence. Just huge meat counters that came from sentient beings who were tortured and then murdered. Or the dairy and milk, where dairy cows and dairy calves are excruciatingly tortured psychologically and physically and then killed. So if you look at those two anchors for grocery stores, they're huge. And here's a third one, alcohol. So you have people going to the store buying tons of booze, tons of meat, tons of dairy, and that becomes the kind of the dominant activity in the store. And when I walk into stores now, I'm super sensitive to it because I'm totally vegan. And we've talked about this, you and I, what a store might look like that had no booze, no dairy, no meat, no high corn syrup, fructose, sugar items, which are really bad for people, or super high sodium content goods. If you took all those out of the stores and you increased your produce times 20, like 20 times, and that everything on your shelves was not a product of violence, and it was absolutely, totally proven to be healthy for human beings, you'd have a different kind of store design. So I could be wrong, but my sense of it is that stores won't change their design because people want meat, dairy, and booze. You know, that's what it is. So how do you move to a different kind of design when you have a value structure that would completely step in the way of it? That's one. And I'll just mention a couple examples. Maybe one will trigger your interest and we can talk about it, but think about primary school education. Really super uncomfortable chairs. I don't know how I ever sat in grade school. I really have no idea. I just have no idea. They're wood, they're not soft, they're not comfortable. And they're all designed towards the teacher in the blackboard, now called a whiteboard, where there's very little eye contact between students and very little circular dynamic, very little interrelational dynamic. It's so alienated, like seriously alienated. So what about that design? Well, I speculate, I could be totally wrong, but I speculate that sort of education design had something to do with cost cutting. How many chairs can we dump into this room with one teacher? That kind of thinking. And that's a very different kind of classroom than what you've explained in Montessori or what I've experienced in other school settings. So yet another design. Or take an example that this will be my third and final example, an example that we talk about all the time is low income apartment buildings. I mean, they're awful. They're seriously horrible. People living in, they're basically cages that look like boxes. They're just cages made of wood. And there's absolutely nothing in them that is stimulating or triggering or interesting in any way, or nothing that's healthy. So you can see how the capitalist domain holds these into check, right? If you were going to try to build a new store, that would be hard because your customers want booze, dairy, and meat. If you want a new apartment building, it's going to be too expensive to build, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think? Does this make sense? How we're just sort of locked in?
Yeah, totally. Like grocery stores, again, you know, you hit it right on the head. You and I have talked about this. Like, what would a grocery store that was actually healthy look like? Well, you take out like 80% of the store. And when people are on diets, even before there was people becoming aware of eating animal products was bad for you, they said to lose weight, you'd walk the perimeter of the store, which was just the fresh produce section where you didn't have any of the products that were made with all these additives. So, well, that would be very different. So I worked in a grocery store for a long time, and there are a lot of companies that make really bad products for you, but they make a lot of money, and they have a lot of money, so they put their products at eye level. A lot of products that are really harmful, like some cereals loaded with sugar, they put on the bottom shelf because they're at eye level to children. They're not at eye level to adults because they know that children will pick up a box and they'll cry and whine and scream and throw a tantrum until they buy it filled with all this. People who watch TV are very aware that there's a lot of commercials. And now, of course, commercials are everywhere, and they're not only on TV, they're on YouTube. They're on everything you watch, even on Facebook. There's ads that interrupt anything that you view. They say ad starting soon. And it's like so irritating, but it isn't that they're doing it just because they have to. It's people who produce those have the money to put into them to do that. That is the heart of predatory capitalism. This is it, to inundate a receptive mind to buy, to purchase, to use things that are bad for them, so that the company can make more money to produce more of the same product to hurt you more. Because let's be sure, even though we have a huge wellness industry going on, we have a huge disease culture going on too. Because that disease culture exists because people are sick. So there's no reason to make them well, because then they won't use the people that are treating them for sickness. We wouldn't have these huge medical complexes. We wouldn't have them anymore. And so that's a threat. That's a threat to those people who are in that industry. They'll lose their jobs, right? And so that all ties into grocery. Grocery stores are all tied into the medical complex. And so I find that really interesting. Grade school is like babysitting. What do you do if you have if you produce too many offspring and you have to work? What do? You need a babysitter. Let's put kid from the time they're 4 years old until the time they're 18. Let's get rid of them 5 days a week at least 8 hours a day. And my God, that's a great concept. Let's just keep them there. And remember, it is all eyes forward, except for very few schools like Montessori or Waldorf in the primary schools. If you look outside, you're daydreaming. So there's no connection to the outdoors. It's none. It's like you are daydreaming, which brings me to some interesting point, is that when kids go wrong and they do bad things, they send them to nature. They send them to an outdoor school to train them and to be more aware of nature. I find that really interesting. If you have done really bad things and there's no hope for you, they'll send you to an outdoor school so that you could become self-sufficient. This is a paradox of the way that we're living. You have to act out in order.
But kids love outdoor schools.
Absolutely.
Kids love them. One of my students is a counselor and teaches teenage kids. And they love it out there. And they start to grow. And then they have to go back home to mom and dad in the city, and they hate it.
Right.
So what would be great is if they could just stay there. It could be a year-round school.
You know, that's very interesting. It's the concept that you have to do damaging things in order to get close to nature. And this works through mental illness, through autism. There's a lot of schools that are built on that concept, like take them away from their parents and the community that they're in, teach them a self-reliant where they could be freer, and they change, and then they send them back to the parents, and of course they change back because that's the way that goes. And you're right, on low income apartment buildings, they're toxic. They're toxic places that are like cages and boxes. They're all built the same way. They don't have anything nice. So what people end up having to do in different degrees is they have to acquire things to make it a home. Military know this. They're put in boxes. They change houses every year or two. And they have to bring everything with them so it feels like home to them. It has nothing to do with a sense of place. It has to do with you have to cart everything with you in order for you to feel comfortable. And we have to change what we think. And the only way to change is to really be aware. Most people are very aware that meat is harmful now. But I would say that it's become commonplace for people to have heard that if you eat meat, it's harmful to you. And there's a great quote by William Wilberforce, and he says, "You may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you didn't know." And that's what goes on today. I mean, that's what goes on with glyphosate, eating meat, torturing animals. You can choose a different way, but you can't say you didn't know.
This is true. So, okay, I find this conversation to be valuable. And part of it, I think, is because we're talking about what it would take to move away from this old structure. So I think we should continue on this way next week. We are out of time. So thank you, Nazarita, very much. Thank you to all of our listeners. Today's March 15th. We are supported by the Existential Psychoanalytic Institute and Society and Earth Science Design. We'll be back with you March 22nd, 10 o'clock in the morning, Mountain Time. Until then, be well. This is Kevin Boylo, co-host of Epis Radio, signing out.